It's the E-commerce Master Plan Podcast, here to help you solve your marketing problems and grow your e-commerce business. Cutting through the hype to bring you inspiration and advice from the e-commerce sector and beyond. Here's your host, Chloe Thomas.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for hitting play on this milestone episode. 10 years and a few days ago, the first episode of the E-commerce Master Plan podcast went live. On June 12th, 2015, we launched episodes 0, 1 and 2, and so began my career as a podcaster. Ever since then, we've put out an episode every single Monday on this show, apart from that one time the email scheduling screwed up and we had to publish early, but that was a while ago. For last year's episode 500 celebration, we created and released an epic ebook of 500 tips for increasing profits in your e-commerce store. Now, that's still available to download, ecmp.info/500. And we accompanied it with an episode featuring experts and guests sharing their top profit tips, which is also well worth a listen. Now, to celebrate the 10 years of podcasting milestone, we didn't want to do that again because, quite frankly, the ebook was a hugely, crazily large amount of work to pull together and I just couldn't do it again, not this year anyway. So instead, we are putting the podcast, or rather me, Chloe, the host, at the centre of our celebration. So in our celebratory episode, this very episode, I will be answering questions submitted by you lot, our listeners. They're on a wide variety of topics, so get ready to go on an interesting, insightful journey with me on this one. And this episode is just the beginning of our 10-year celebration, so expect more over the next few months, maybe even a live show. Watch this space. 10 years as a podcaster. Did you know? Get ready for some stats. I've been the host of over 5 shows in that time, including our 2 shows, obviously. This one, the E-commerce Master Plan, our marketing podcast, Keep Optimizing. One for the UK government, quite strangely, as part of the 2020 Dubai World Expo, which because of COVID didn't even happen in 2020, it was still called 2020. That was an interesting series. I also did 4 seasons of one about business startups for a publication in the UK, and my own very small solo show talking about taking a business to next zero. And that is one I really need to stop neglecting and share, because we have been doing stuff about going towards net zero in the business. I just haven't been writing about it and reading it out for the podcast. So I need to revive that show. But anyway, enough of my to-do list. Did you know? All of that means that I've recorded well over 900 episodes as the host, which is kind of mad and almost doesn't seem to add up, because that would mean like 90 a year. But then that does... Anyway, I waffle. Okay, let's get back on track, Chloe. Plus, I've also been a guest on many, many other shows. So that gives me, as a conservative estimate, that there's over 20 days worth of recorded content by me, and that's ignoring the ebooks, webinars, etc. that are out there as well. Oh, please don't go and try and listen to it all. No sponsorship money in the world could, you know, for any good cause be worth doing that. But yeah, over 20 days worth of podcasts. Absolutely mind-boggling. Now, whether you've listened to one episode or hundreds of them, I really thank you for tuning in, because all the content I create is about helping other people do better with their business, with their careers. So the fact you've listened to one or hundreds really makes this worthwhile. So thank you so much. Right. That's enough numbers and history. Let's crack on with this episode. So huge thanks to all of you who submitted a question. We've included almost all of the questions here. If I haven't answered it in the episode, it means I will be getting back to you personally, because it was a bit too in-depth to be here. But thank you all for submitting those questions, and I hope you find the answers meet your expectations. We have a real mix of questions coming up, from the super specific through to the very broad. And I wasn't really expecting this, they are nearly all about e-commerce rather than podcasting. So let's kick off with the non-e-commerce one, not least because it's from one of the best people in UK e-commerce and a past guest of the show. So thank you, Janice Thomas, Managing Director at Look Fabulous Forever, for this one. What is the most surprising thing that's happened while recording an episode? Oh, so many random things happen during the recordings of episodes. I generally chat to guests for like 5 to 15 minutes before we start recording. And often the weird things happen then. So I'm going to include that in the answer. The weirdest one, I think, probably was a guest who booked in to record at a time when they were staying, they were a digital nomad and they were staying in a flat next to a mosque, and they booked the recording for the same time as the call to prayer happened, which strangely enough meant we had to rebook to a different time slot because I figured the listeners didn't need the call to prayer happening in an e-commerce podcast and there was no way we could sound insulate them well enough. That was quite a weird one. During and post-pandemic, we got a lot of children and dogs. We've had a delivery driver turn up partway through. I mean, to be fair, most of this we edit out, so you're not going to find it in the shows. There was one we left in relatively early on with Alex from Serious Readers, where his team started playing a loud game. I think it was like bowls or something partway through in the office. It was quite impressively loud, but we left that one in because it kind of fitted in with some of what he'd been saying. And I was in the mood where I quite liked the atmosphere, to be honest. Quite often that's why sounds do get left in. One of the weirdest ones that I often come back to was with my own head, and no names on this one, is someone who knows plenty about podcasting, let's put it that way, who had booked on as a guest and who got quite annoyed with me when I suggested that the traffic noise of downtown New York was not acceptable for a podcast recording and had no interest in fixing that at all, which I find quite fascinating because, like, one of the key things in podcasting is respecting the audience's ears. You know, you guys don't want to hear a siren going off whilst you're driving along. So that was a bit of an odd one. That was a strange one to deal with during a recording session. I had Michael Gerber selling me post-podcast recording, the E-Myth guy. I was quite impressed by that, actually. So on point. He then tried to sell me into one of his coaching programs. I also had someone once try to record in a parked car with a broken window in January. For their own good, I wouldn't allow them to do that one, and we rebooked. By far the weirdest thing, though, that has ever happened in a recording, and this one immediately sprang to mind when I read this question, but it wasn't technically a podcast recording, was a virtual summit recording a few years ago with Matt Williams from Returnalize, where we're just doing our recording thing. And my husband, who never interrupts my work normally, appeared at the window of the building, which I can see just out the corner of my eye, wearing Dayglo running gear, and caused me to completely jump out of my skin. My reaction's quite impressive. Matt's reaction is super impressive. And if I get a chance in the next week or so, I will share it on LinkedIn if anyone wants to watch, because it is quite entertaining. So that is definitely the weirdest thing ever in a recording. Okay, I hope that sufficiently answered your question there, Janice. Where do we go next? Who's going to do question two? Well, I think let's go for the broad questions first, and then we'll niche in and then broaden out again for the very last question. Might not entirely make sense to you guys at this point in time, but that will as we go through. So question two is from Edward Scott Finnegan, the webinar connoisseur. Now, you may wonder why he's asked me to read him out as the webinar connoisseur. Well, Edward turns up to pretty much all our webinars, and he's probably now going to message me going, "I've been to all of them, Chloe." He comes along to all of them, and it's always, I very much believe Edward's point of view on e-commerce content. He also, you know, is a head of e-commerce, an e-commerce business as well. So he does really know his stuff very practically too. So I named him in one of our sessions, the webinar connoisseur. So Edward, thank you so much for taking the time to submit some questions. This one is, after 10 years of podcasting, what's the one constant that has remained the same and will continue in the e-commerce sphere? Interestingly, I don't often get asked this question. Now, I frequently get asked what's changed, but rarely what stayed the same. And I'm actually more interested in what stayed the same. For me, the thing that stayed the same for the last 10 years, and actually my whole 20 odd years career, is that we're still trying to achieve the same goals. We're still trying to get the customers to buy from us. And most of the ways we do that haven't really changed in terms of what we're trying to achieve. We're still trying to build great welcome sequences that turn inquirers into buyers. We're still trying to build online experiences that increase the chances of the repeat purchase. We're still trying to perfect the messaging that drives the sales. We're still trying to optimize the advertising channels. Yes, the platforms and some of the channels where we do this have changed. Some of the language has changed. But because human behavior hasn't really changed that much in a fundamental sense, I know we now have mobiles and all those sorts of things. But basically, we're all still trying to do the same things. So yes, attention spans are getting shorter, but we're still drawn to the same sort of content. We still have the same human drivers. So as businesses, our goals and our fundamental consumer behavior drivers haven't changed. Urgency still works. FOMO still works. Discounts still work. Limited time offers still work. All that stuff still works. So that's my thing that I don't think has changed, is that we are still trying to find the most effective way to get the right customers to buy our products. And that just hasn't changed. There will be another question from Edward, the webinar connoisseur, coming up later. Now, very helpfully and completely unplanned, honestly, no planning in this at all. It's just one of those lucky serendipity things. Jamie Huskinson, the CEO at JH, the breakthrough agency and organiser of Meet Magento UK, has asked the opposite question. And he also submitted it as audio, so we can hear him ask it. Over to you, Jamie.
Hello, Chloe. This is Jamie from JH, long-time guest, first-time Q&A-er. My question for you is, what has surprised you in e-commerce over the last 10 years? You've seen it all, right? 10 years is an absolutely massive amount of time. What's the thing that just took you by surprise and you thought, that's never going to happen? Never. And then all of a sudden, absolute cornerstone that you are trying to get on top of. And if you want to go one step further, what's the thing that right now you think people is going to be an absolute cornerstone of e-commerce that actually you're writing off and you're saying, no, that's 6 months, nobody's going to hear a thing? Thanks, Chloe.
So what's been the biggest surprise of the last 10 years and what am I writing off? I mean, that's a tough one. But anyway, let's do the surprise first. Now, this also had me stumped a bit, partly because I'm very much a look forward, not a look back person. So I'm not the greatest at remembering the details of the past. I'm better on the stories, which I admit is very embarrassing for an Oxford trained historian. But I had the same problem back then. Could remember the story. Terrible at the dates, and getting the names of the kings correct was quite challenging as well. Anyway, enough of my academic career. So let's rewrite the question a little bit. And I hope you don't mind me doing this, Jamie. But the things I find most weird at the moment, what's weird in the e-commerce space right now? People are still using Magento 1. This is quick background for those of you not familiar with this part of the e-commerce world. Magento killed off Magento 1 and moved to Magento 2 in a way where you couldn't click a button and upgrade. You had to build a completely new website and announce they wouldn't be supporting Magento 1 anymore years ago. Years and years and years ago. And they thought, you know, within 18 months, everyone would have moved, but there are still an awful lot of people running websites, running successful businesses on Magento 1. And the reason I find that, in some ways, actually, I don't find that weird at all, because I think those of us creating the noise in the industry, the podcasters, the bloggers, the agencies, the software providers, et cetera, we often not expect too much, but expect the actual people doing the e-commerce to behave in different ways to those that they actually will. And I think Magento 1 is a good reminder that if something's working for someone and if it doesn't make sense in their business to change it, they're not going to. So that is one of those weird things, is that people are still using Magento 1. They're still using old systems to do things in a way that they find sufficiently successful. Otherwise, let's face it, they'd move. Second weird thing at the moment is that the boutique e-commerce store still thrives. Now, what I mean by boutique is, and this is something I talked about back in my very first book, the book called E-commerce Master Plan, a boutique e-commerce store is an e-commerce store that buys in products from other people and sells it. So think of like a boutique fashion store on the high street. They buy in different fashion brands, stock, collate it into a collection, and they sell it as a boutique. So you go to a boutique online or offline for their ability to select the right products. And back when I wrote the book, I was making the point that I thought boutique was a difficult way to go because online, you don't have that experiential side of things that you do in a real world boutique. You know, in a real world boutique, you can make all the products work together. You can do all that sort of thing, but you can't do that online. Plus, because of the way in which e-commerce relies so heavily on keywords, even now, you know, discovery and selling relies so much on words that if you're selling other people's products, you have a lot less control of your activity. So the opposite to a boutique would be a D2C. So you create your products and you sell your own products. And let's just be super clear, boutique is fundamentally different from marketplace, because marketplace is where other people are using your software to sell. It's not where you're buying goods from someone and then listing them and selling them. So I find it quite mad that the boutique e-commerce store still works in some sectors, but I think it always has a limited time span on it. You know, there's like a point that you see a lot at the moment where they bring together sustainable products or lower carbon footprint products. But I think that's a temporary opportunity as consumers learn. So it kind of helps consumers learn for a bit and then it's done and dusted. So I find it quite mad that there are still people creating boutique e-commerce stores. If I ever create an e-commerce store, it won't be boutique. It will be products that I've created, which is probably why I'll never get around to doing it. Number three, weird things in e-commerce is... how many events is too many? How many events about e-commerce do we need in a year? And I am not just talking about massive expos. I am talking about webinars, private dinners, special breakfasts, lunches, virtual summits, conferences, shows, sessions, networking events. There just seems to be so many events. I mean, I know they're great for marketing, and I know that that you know, software companies seem to have a lot of budget for it at the moment. A lot of the partnership programs are based on investing in events, but surely we must be reaching the point of diminishing returns, because the number of events going on in some weeks is absolutely insane, and I don't hear about anywhere near as many as actual brands and retailers do. You know, I tend to only hear about the ones that want to be promoted, but the ones where, you know, they're inviting with their own list or with their own partners list, where they're not coming to marketing tools like me and my business, I don't hear about any of those, or the private invite ones. So yeah, how many events do we need in the UK? I mean, admittedly, if you're not in London, it's not quite so bad. But it is mad how many events there are going on. And I just can't think that any one brand side could be getting anything done if there's enough value in those events. Anyway, I could rant about that and discuss that for many hours, and I have done. So if you fancy discussing that, find me at an event and we'll have a good old chinwag about it. Other weird thing, the boom in wholesaling in D2C. So D2C businesses selling to other businesses who will then sell their products. So I guess selling to boutiques and selling to bigger high street chains and that kind of thing. The listeners of this show, you guys, you are more likely to be selling wholesale than you are to be selling on a marketplace, right? That's what our surveys of you suggest. So and wholesale is such a different business model to opening a physical store or to selling on marketplaces, because it requires a completely different skill set. You need salespeople, you need to do relationship building, which isn't generally something you have to do when you're selling via a website. So I find it quite mad how big that wholesaling boom is. And also because obviously you're making a lot less margin, more volume, which is great, but less margin. So I find it quite mad the big boom we're seeing in wholesale in the D2C space. Okay, four big surprises, four weird things I find at the moment. So that's part one of Jamie's question. Jamie's question part two is what I'm writing off. Oh, another tricky side of things. So I generally try not to jump on new bandwagons. I like to let the early adopters iron out the crinkles before I jump in. So I'm still, and I'll be honest about it, I'm still a bit of an AI laggard. We're using it in various places in the business, but we're not using it in as many places as we could, and I'll be working on that over the summer. But I'm not writing AI off. I don't writing off AI at all. What would I write off? The complete death of the website. That's the one I don't quite get at the moment. So there's been, when ChatGPT and Shopify announced their integration to be putting buy buttons into the ChatGPT results, there were people saying this will be the end of the website. Then we had more recently the Google announcements that they are going to be bringing buy buttons. Oh, I can't remember if it's on the SERPs page or if it's in Gemini, but it's very much, they're becoming much more AI driven, which means they're going to start being adding buy buttons into the actual, you know, search results, into the Google pages rather than onto your website pages. Again, the suggestion of the complete death of the website. Now, I get why people are arguing that. And I get that it will have an impact and it's going to be another sales channel we need to manage. Like we manage our marketplace and we manage our D2C and we manage our B2B and we manage our physical stores. And it's going to be another channel to deal with. But I don't think it's going to be the death of the website. Partly because, rolling back to the weird things, my first weird thing, people are still using Magento 1. People are not all going to jump into that new level. That new level of using AI rather than search engines, buying, being happy buying from a search engine rather than buying from your own website. So I think we've both got the sellers, the e-commerce industry, not moving as fast towards this as people think. And I think customers will not move all of them anyway to this. So I don't think we're going to see the complete death of the website. I think we'll see the website evolving as it keeps evolving, but I do not believe we're going to see the complete death of the website. In 10 years' time, if I got that massively wrong, feel free to tell me the timestamp and the episode and remind me. I don't mind. But yeah, that's the thing which I am writing off right now, is the idea that all these AI buy button movements are going to leave the website dead. I just don't think it's going to happen. Right. Okay. Let's finish off our big picture questions before we go more specific. This one is from Tony Susan, who's a fractional CTO. And he says, crazy how fast e-commerce has changed. What tech do you think really flipped the script for online sellers these past 10 years? Well, Tony, I have to say Shopify, don't I? But let's expand on that. One thing I've noticed, and I'm not the only one, is that every now and then we get tech that comes along that's built on new tech foundations. So they're not struggling to retrofit a legacy tech stack. They've come in fresh and fully built to purpose and ready to deliver the next generation of activity and functionality for us and for our customers. That's what Shopify did. And it led to a massive change in the space. Remember all those, we built an e-commerce store and drove $1,000 in sales in 3 days blogs? God, I read so many of those. It's also what Klaviyo and others did in the email space. Now, in both cases, it wasn't just the new tech stack foundations that enabled them to shift the script for online sellers. What they also did was excellent marketing to direct to the users of their software, to the e-commerce businesses. And they also both built powerful partner teams to drive those sales. So a clear growth strategy, a fresh tech stack that really delivered, and serious problem-solving activity to help build those sales channels is what worked. In both cases, all of that enabled teams to do what had taken tens of thousands of pounds and hours of team project management work into things that the average marketer or founder could do in a bit more than a few clicks, but not much more. I still remember when I was shown how we could set up an email welcome campaign ourselves without having to brief it and pay a fee. Madness. In fact, I think that was with Adestra. Anyone remember Adestra? And let's add a mad fact in here. I was the first client to send email marketing on the Adestra platform that tracked sales values. Yes, conversion tracking on email. It was groundbreaking at the time and so, so cool. Anyway, I digress. That was well more than 10 years ago. So how these businesses really flipped the script was in changing the industry mindset, especially Shopify. And that's what we're seeing now with AI. I had to mention it, okay? We're seeing a mindset shift. We're seeing people think differently about how they solve the problems in their own businesses. They're thinking, how can we automate that? How can we be more efficient? And that's where AI is delivering. And it's making us all think differently about how to run our marketing, activity, content, customer support, et cetera, et cetera. So I think Shopify in particular massively flipped the script in terms of what they gave us in functionality and then how they changed our industry and our industry mindset and got people thinking very differently about their websites and how they made them work. And I think in the next 10 years, we're going to see AI do it. But again, I think the biggest shift AI is going to create is in the mindset we take of how we run our businesses and how we make them work. Okay. Whilst that was getting relatively specific, let's get into the specific questions. First of these is a question from past guest Tamsin Burford, and Tamsin is from women's ski wear boutique Winter National. And Tamsin asks, how to continue growing a niche seasonal online business? Now, Winter National is a ski wear boutique, so obviously she's running a niche seasonal online business. So I love this question. And quite a lot is changing in the marketing arena at the moment. So I want to kind of clarify a little bit about when I'm actually recording this, so you've got the context of where I'm coming from. This is the week after the big Google SERPs changing announcements, all those big announcements that came out of the big Google conference. So that's feeding into my thoughts, but not necessarily consciously relevant to this. And the challenge with a niche seasonal business like Winter National is that your customers' interest, as well as their spending, is usually seasonal. You've got to keep them warm through the off season, but they aren't interested in hearing about ski outfits in August, I assume. The opportunity is that you get to have an on season and an off season, which can make for super levels of clarity in your workload and messaging at different times of the year. So the first thing I would do, if you haven't done it already, is map the team workload and goals for the year, working out the seasons where we're working on things. So that would include like a deadline, maybe an October deadline for all tech updates to the website to be completed before people start buying the ski wear. Time to get the marketing ready in advance of the selling season. So if the sales season is, let's say, November to March, then by the end of October, you've already scheduled a whole load of your email marketing and you've already created all your ad graphics. Obviously, there'll be more during the season, but that will then free you up to do the active optimization and the improvements rather than creating. I'd also schedule in a full review at the end of the season. So a dedicated week, maybe where you go through all the numbers and really pick everything apart so you can begin the planning for the next season. The next thing I'd do is survey the customer base to find out what you could talk to them about in the off season and find out who wants to hear about skiing in the off season. Then combine that qualitative data with what you already know about your customer behavior from sales and marketing activity and all the rest of it to create a 12-month long marketing plan. So I'm thinking things like sneak previews on the new season fashions, profiles of the best resorts for the coming season, care guides, asking for feedback, yoga to do to get yourself ready for the ski season, reveals of the new ranges, all that sort of stuff. I am not a skier. I have never been skiing. So forgive me if any of this is utterly ridiculous, but you get the idea. Why am I talking a 12-month marketing campaign? Well, because you can't turn an e-commerce store on and off anymore and hope it will deliver. In the off season, you've got to keep gaining some level of engagement and brand awareness retention of your audience. So email and SMS signups and social media follows are what you really want to be going for in the off season. So you're continuing to be there, you're continuing to be alive, you're continuing to drive engagement. You also need to remain front of mind for the customers, and that's partly going to be about continuing to be interesting or useful to them in the off season, but it's also about being ready to launch the new season well and being great throughout that season. As to what I'd be putting on that marketing plan, which I'm guessing is probably what you most wanted to hear about, UGC on social, and I'd take that as far as influencer marketing, probably micro influencer marketing. I'd be looking at PR. Where can we get those news stories ahead of time? What publications can we get into? Can we get featured in? I'd also be looking at affiliates. There is some super cool stuff now in affiliates on the luxury side of things and on the getting into the press side of things at the moment. So I'd definitely be exploring that. And finally, and here, Tamsin, is your curveball in this answer. What about adding re-commerce to the mix? Instead of your customers selling last year's gear on Vinted, let them return it to you for some store credit ahead of the next season. Then either open a secondhand store yourselves or sell it on Vinted yourselves, or do a partnership with a store like Worn by Us who will sell it on your behalf and give you a cut of the sales. That would give you a really cool way of being relevant to your customers for a longer time span and may well bring in new customers as well. Stats show this can have a great impact on retention and lifetime value. And you could even do it, you could limit it to the products you've actually sold, but you could also restrict it by brand. Because I know you sell a number of different brands of ski gear, so you could buy back anything from those brands and use that as store credit to get those customers to make sure they come back to buy next season's outfits from you. Okay, let's pause for the sponsor slot and then we'll be back with some more super focused questions for you. Okay, I've got three more questions and answers for you, and looking at the clock of the recording time, which is a little bit longer than what you guys are actually going to hear, crikey, I'm putting a lot in this one, aren't I? Maybe I should have edited the questions a bit more. Oh well, this is going to be a long episode. We'll all have to deal with it. Okay, first of our final three questions comes from Kelly A. Mahoney from Clear Mail. Great to get a question in from you, Kelly. Thank you. She says, congratulations, Chloe, on your 10 years. I would be curious to know about the most innovative growth strategies for online businesses that you've heard during your 10 years of podcasting. Okay, Kelly, I tried to think of a UK example here, but I couldn't come up with one. So the two I've got are stateside. First off, we've got Colin from Sheets and Giggles and his podcast sponsorship strategy. Now, podcast advertising itself isn't really innovative. The majority of podcast ad spend globally is brands advertising consumer goods. But what Colin did was to sponsor a basketball podcast and go all in, pivoting their social to it as well. Now, you can catch that in episode 410. I am not going to attempt to explain the strategy here, but it's worked. It works so well for them. But yeah, a sheep brand sponsoring a basketball podcast makes no sense, but it worked really well. And if you're vaguely interested in that, watch out for a deep dive into podcast advertising we're hoping to do later this year on Keep Optimizing. Second idea for you, Kelly, is from Ian Leslie from Industry West, who's been on the show a few times now. Always great to have Ian on the show. They sell furniture mainly to restaurants and offices, and one of their key markets is Manhattan. But advertising in Manhattan is quite expensive. So he found a service where he could buy the side of a local Manhattan delivery van or two. So vans driving around the city with Industry West advertising on the sides of the vans. No Industry West product in the van, but they have his adverts on the side, so it looks like they're his vans. So they drive around his target market all week long. They don't go anywhere else, they're only in Manhattan, looking like Industry West vans, which both adds in advertising in his target market, but also creates an element of social proof. Gosh, Industry West must be doing a lot of business here. I see their van around all the time. What I love about those two strategies is they come from knowing your customer base really well and from being ready to take a punt and test a different move. And I think that's when I get the most excited by things that people talk about on the podcast, is when they've done things which seem, on the face of it, seem like a mad idea. But the more you pick through the strategy and the way they've been thinking about it, the more it's actually, it is a bit of a leap, but it's not a crazy leap when they know, when you really understand their customer base as they do. So those would be the two. Hope that that's an acceptable answer, Kelly. Right, let's switch to retention. And this question from Liv Staub, who's the Senior Product Marketing Manager at Yotpo Email. And Liv has recorded her question for us, so let's hear it from Liv.
Hi, Chloe, and everyone listening to the E-commerce Master Plan podcast today. Such a special episode. Happy anniversary. 10 years is a huge milestone. So congratulations from the entire Yotpo team and cheers to many more. My name is Liv and I'm the Senior Product Marketing Manager for Yotpo Email, which is our newest product fully integrated with our SMS, reviews, and loyalty products. So of course, we take retention very seriously here at Yotpo. And no surprise here, my question for Chloe is going to revolve all around that. So Chloe, what does retention mean to you in your line of work? Why should merchants pay attention to their retention metrics? And after 10 years of interviewing different thought leaders, what would you say are some tested and true ways to retain customers in e-commerce, especially today? So I guess that's not one question, but retention's such a big topic, I just can't help it. Hope we get some great insights and thank you for this wonderful opportunity.
Okay, the retention question. So for me, retention starts with the customers you recruit. If you sell to the right customers in the first place, you are more likely to sell to them again. But retention is throttled in terms of what it can do for your sales volume because it's limited by the number of past customers you have. The retention metric I'm most interested in is how the number of first, second, and third, etc. time customers grows. Usually looking at that by cohort or season. So of spring, summer 22, how many bought in the last 12 months? This enables you to understand how what you actually did changed. Like, it's great looking at a long-term, you know, an overall customer lifetime value and seeing that go up a bit. But for starters, that will change by season based on which customers buy in different seasons. For example, if you're a gift business, I bet you your customer lifetime value is better for customers who buy between February and, let's say, August than it is for customers who buy in November and December. I bet you that's what it looks like. So I'm not a fan of like the big old number because I don't think it actually tells you that much. I like to drill it down to how are we getting our customers to buy more frequently? Looking at that by season and also then drilling down into different marketing channels so you can work out how to then go about changing and optimizing based on how the numbers look. The frustrating thing about this, of course, is that you have to wait. You can't look at last week's numbers and you know, change things. You have to do a bit of waiting, which is somewhat frustrating. But anyway, and then what are the tried and tested ways to retain customers? Well, for me, number one would be recruit the right customers in the first place. Secondly, don't screw up their first purchase. Make sure they buy the right product and that it arrives well and that they know how to consume it. Get those three things right and you're well on your way. Thirdly, know when the best times are for you to get them to buy again. When are your customers likely to buy again? For almost everyone, it's immediately after they bought. You might think that sounds mad, but it's true. Hugely likely to get someone to buy from you within days, hours, a couple of weeks of when they first bought. So make sure you've got that post-purchase, immediately post-purchase marketing activity working really well. It's also why the experience of the first purchase is so critical. Often it can be 12 months after the first purchase for gifting and seasonal things, or it can be when they need to restock. So there's lots of different stages and businesses can be very, very different. So you need to understand when those best times are for them to buy. And then to find the right way to remind them to buy again, which is both about your channel, so email, direct mail, parcel inserts within your ad funnels, but it's also about the right messaging. And you may be in a business that's lucky enough to have like a product purchase journey where they pretty much everyone buys this first and the next thing they buy is product B and then they go on to product C. So if that's the way, then that makes life a lot easier for you. But work out what the the why messages are, and then get that in the right places in the marketing activity. It's as easy as that, she says. It's not, is it? But anyway, that's my take on retention. We've got to the final question, and we're going to wrap up with Edward again, our webinar connoisseur. And he's asking a super tricky one for me to finish with. What advice would you give to the current and future generations of e-commerce people? What legacy would you pass on? Mega, mega question there. Thank you, Edward. This may not go in the direction you think I should take it, but I'm going in this direction because it's the direction I want to go in. So first off, be nice and friendly. This is a lovely industry. 90-95% of the people in it are super helpful and always friendly. So continue that, please, everybody. Help each other out as much as you can and where you can. And I think that's just absolute 101. Help each other share. I mean, the amount of sharing that goes on between brands of knowledge and ideas is quite scary. And those of us on supplier side rarely get to hear about it. But trust me, they're talking to each other. So be nice and friendly. That would be my first. Secondly, leave the ego at the door. Kind of goes hand in hand with the first one. But yeah, leave the ego behind. You can smell people with an ego miles off in this industry. And I've rarely seen them get very far. So leave your ego behind and be nice and friendly. Thirdly, never stop learning. You will never know it all. If there's any one thing you can take from my 20 years in this industry, is there's still large parts of it I don't understand at all. So you can never know it all. There's always something new to learn about. So always be open to learning new things from new members of your team, at conferences, from books, from podcasts, obviously from podcasts. Listen to lots of podcasts. But yeah, never stop learning. Always be open to new ideas. Always test. Don't take any idea as a definite win. Take everything you hear as something you could test. It's not, oh, they said that would work. I'll implement it tomorrow and it'll be great. Not necessarily. Think of it as something to test. Always test. And don't believe the hype. We remain an industry which creates far more noise than it really deserves to create, both in digital marketing and in e-commerce. There's so many blogs and webinars, and there's so much competition in that space. A lot of it inevitably ends up quite clickbaity and hypey. So don't believe the hype. Look for the sensible, pragmatic advice within it all. And I hope that helps the current and future generations of e-commerce bods to thrive and to do great and fun things. Well, everybody, there we go. The AMA, the Ask Me Anything, is complete. Thank you hugely to all our podcasting team, past and present, everyone who's been involved with the show over the last 10 years. We could not have made it here without your help. And I remain hugely thankful to all of you for your contributions. To all those involved in all the podcasts I've hosted and been on, huge thank you to you. I learned something doing all of those different things. And it's always fun to get to do something that I didn't set the strategy for. Always interesting to do that. Thank you, all of you out there who've listened this far in this very long episode. Thank you for listening to this one. Thank you for listening to all the episodes that you do. And I hope you're going to listen to lots more. Thank you to everyone who submitted their questions. You really got me thinking, and I hope the answers have been as good as your questions. And if you like this episode, this AMA format, let me know. We can always do another one. If you've got other questions you'd like to hear me answering, we could always do that again if you've liked this. Okay, to get your hands on the notes from this episode, then head over to ecommercemasterplan.com or use our direct episode short link. That's ecmp.info/the number of this episode. Just put that in the URL bar and you will go straight to the right page on the website. When you get to the website, don't forget to download our 500 tips ebook and get signed up to our email list. And yeah, if you want something to listen to next, why not head to episode 500, last year's mega episode, which is packed with ideas and ways for you to improve your business and make it more profitable. I bring out a new episode of the E-commerce Masterplan podcast every single week to inspire and help e-commerce business owners like all of you to succeed and thrive with your businesses, including progressing along the path to net zero. So if you know someone this show can help, please tell them to listen to the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. I hope you have a brilliant week, and here's to the next 10 years.
Thank you for listening to the E-commerce Masterplan podcast. Find out more at ecommercemasterplan.com/podcast.